welcome to the second Strange Attractor podcast, which we've decided to do late on a Sunday night after a couple of glasses of wine. We thought we'd just have like a bit of a chat about some of the conferences we've been to, about my current obsession with Second Life, and with another life, this American life. So, yeah, I guess we're going to start with Eurofoo.
So this was the second Foo conference you've been to in a couple of weeks, Sue. How did Eurofoo compare to Foo Camp out in Sebastopol? I just like saying Sebastopol, so.
Well, yeah, I was lucky enough to get an invite to both Foo Camp and Eurofoo, which for anyone who doesn't know, these are little conferences organized by O'Reilly Media, a big publishing company out in Sebastopol. They do a lot of tech books. They do the Hacks series. They do Make magazine. And basically, Tim O'Reilly and his team pick a bunch of people they think are cool and interesting and invite them to these little two-day conferences. God knows why I was invited, but
I was just waiting for that little bit of self-deprecation to creep in, but go on.
Well, I suspect it's, you know, the hours I've spent, you know, chatting to Nat Talkington and threatening him with stilettos that probably did it. Less said about that, the better. But yeah, Eurofoo was great fun. It was really good. I mean, Fufu, as we decided we were going to call the original Foo Camp, you know, there were quite a lot of people there this year. It was like 320 odd people. There were kind of too many people to really get to chat to everyone, but it was an absolutely fantastic experience of, you know, camping out in Tim O'Reilly's orchard and just talking about really amazing, weird stuff like body modification, and we had robots that could do handstands and cartwheels and stuff.
Didn't you also have a flyover by Google folks?
Yeah, Google sent a plane. So myself and Tom Coates, I think it was probably Tom's idea, he went and got a load of card and cut it into large squares, and we laid out some Space Invaders. So we're
a really low power monitor on the lawn, though, right? A
very, very low power monitor.
Refresh rate was probably a little slow too.
And very patchy as well. I mean, every time the wind gusted, we had to refresh the screen
I'm so glad that my PowerBook screen, despite having lots of dead pixels now, isn't prone to wind interference.
I think the guys who did the crashed Cylon Raider out of bin bags actually had a better idea, because they nailed theirs to the ground, literally, with big nails. No flyover in Brussels at Eurofoo, because we were basically in a hotel, so it would have been fairly pointless, really. But just as much of an interesting mix of people, interesting conversations, some fantastic sessions. Brilliant session by a guy called Tor, whose surname I'm not even going to begin to try and pronounce, who did a session on chocolate, which was just, and actually brought chocolate, and you know, we tasted it, and it was just this amazing mix of.
So I miss chocolate and vodka. Did you get any chocolate tips? Any new types of chocolate that you'd like to have?
Well, it was interesting figuring out, actually finally learning what this percentage business is all about. So when you see a bar of chocolate and it says like 75% or 85% or 99%, what that means is the percentage of stuff that's not sugar. So 85% bar has 15% sugar and the rest is cocoa butter, cocoa powder and whatever else that they decide to put in it. So the interesting thing about the percent is that some companies, some nefarious chocolate manufacturers, are apparently trying to corrupt the percent measure, because it's a percentage that isn't something else. It doesn't actually tell you, say, how much percent cocoa powder is in it. So what some companies do is that they adulterate the chocolate with, you know, cheap vegetable fat or something, which then makes it a lower quality. So that was quite interesting. But the best chocolate that we tasted was an 85% Lindt bar, and there was a 99% bar. So this is a bar that is only 1% sugar and 99% cocoa butter and powder. And oh my God, that was just so bitter and unchocolatey and almost inedible, actually.
Yeah, I mean, you'd almost use that for a cooking bar that then you'd add sugar to. Yeah. I say putting my baker's hat on, so, but at any rate.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there are some people who really love their chocolate bitter, and I'm sure they would enjoy it. I think the 75% was a bit too waxy and a bit too, you know, feeble for me. And, you know, we also had some much lower percentage chocolate that really, it's like the difference between, you know, Hershey's and, you know, high-end Scharfenberger or, you know, really decent Lindt chocolate. But, I mean, I don't know half as much about chocolate as I would like to know, but I learned a lot from Tor. It was a really good session.
Did they have some nice Valrhona or anything like that?
I think Tor Wilson wasn't going to bring some chocolate, but someone suggested he go out and get some. So he kind of like ran across to the Leonidas store and kind of went, "What chocolate have you got? You know, I want some, you know, 85% chocolate." And they looked at him as if he was mad and kind of fobbed him off with some stuff. So yeah, it wasn't a very wide chocolate tasting, but it was a really fascinating session. It was really good.
Now you did learn something valuable about how to properly eat chocolate.
Oh yeah, apparently only amateurs chew. I'm going to get a t-shirt made up that says that. You're supposed to...
Real people suck?
You are supposed to suck your chocolate, yes. You're supposed to let it melt on the mouth so that you can experience the full pleasure of the chocolate taste. So, but chocolate wasn't what it was all about. There was a lot of tech. There were some incredibly cool people. Lots of talking about things like the future of spying with Fiona Romeo. She's doing putting together an exhibition for the Science Museum. So that was kind of like what science spying going to be like in 20 years. So that was kind of a lot of fun. There was a fantastic session by Ryan Carson about working a 4-day week, which I'm particularly in favour of. And there was Matt Jones, Matt Webb and Simon Willison who all like came together to run a session on how could we build a tricorder now with the technology we have and with the information we have. And this was mainly based around the idea of answering Kevin Kelly's Big Here questions, which are questions like Point North. What time is sunrise and sunset? When the rain falls, you know, which direction does it flow in? Which river does it flow to? What happens to your sewage when you flush the toilet? That kind of, you know, local environmental stuff that frankly you get really divorced from if you live in a big city. You don't really think about where your waste goes. You don't really think about telling the difference between plants and weeds. You don't really think about, okay, what is the bedrock here, what's the soil here. So that was really actually a very interesting session to try and think, you know, how could we actually make a tool that would help people understand their locality in more detail. So yeah, Eurofoo was fantastic, really really good time. And then of course followed straight on from Eurofoo was EuroOSCON, which is the open source conference that O'Reilly had organised in the same hotel. And that was equally great, actually. I was kind of expecting to be a little bit out of my depth because I'm not a big programmer. But there were some fantastic sessions. Tom Steinberg from My Society did a brilliant session on democratising government and how to replicate some of the work that My Society's been doing with sites like They Work For You and Right For Them. These are all kind of e-democracy sites that They Work For You takes the Hansard records of what's happened in Parliament and makes them readable and searchable and pulls out the statistics and presents them in a better way. And Right To Them allows you to, just knowing your postcode, to find out who your local councillors and your MPs and your MEPs are and send them letters.
Well, I've been really impressed in the States. They've been doing a lot of projects recently to try to find, bloggers have kind of bound together to try to find out what has happened during certain closed-door sessions in Congress. There are certain parliamentary procedures, if you will, that members of Congress can do completely anonymously. And what they've done is, you know, had people who read their blog call up their member of Congress and say, "Were you the person who did this?" And they have to answer. And so the bloggers have basically distributed out this big job of trying to find out who it does. And, you know, it would be really resource intensive if it were, you know, a single journalist or something. But basically all the readers of a blog going and calling up their congressman person, you know, it's been something really effective. I mean, that's, I see a lot of opportunities in what Tom Steinberg's doing and what, you know, a lot of bloggers in the States are doing, where they're actually trying to hold their members of government to account. And, you know, all this talk about, you know, what can bloggers do that professional journalists might not be able to do. I think this is actually some really interesting projects. But back to your OSCON.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. This is a really interesting area of exposing data that's already there. So I met Rob McKinnon, who is looking at and working on replicating the same kind of My Society tools, like They Work For You and Write To Them in New Zealand. He's based in London, but as a New Zealander, he has a lot of interest in helping people to relate to the New Zealand government. And you know, Adrian Holovaty was at OSCON as well, and his talk was actually about how journalists gather huge amounts of data, which then just gets lost in the story. So he was talking about how you pull out, and I think it's a very similar idea to what Tom and My Society are doing. Is this is about, you know, there's data there that you have, and the issue is not gathering it, but presenting it in a meaningful way. So Adrian was talking about what the Washington Post have done with gathering statistics on servicemen and women killed in Iraq, and then just presenting that data in a more useful and searchable way than having every single name buried in individual stories. So I think, yeah, this is a really interesting trend towards understanding that, you know, data's not just for nerds. Actually, a lot of people find data interesting, and the trick is to figure out what data you've already got and then how you can repackage it and present it to the world for a kind of, you know, for people to do with what they will, in a way.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit of background on Adrian Holovaty for people who might not be familiar with his work. I believe he may not have started there, but he worked at Lawrence Journal World with Rob Curley. And the Lawrence Journal World in Lawrence, Kansas is one of those really unique relatively small-town newspapers that does some very interesting cutting-edge internet stuff. And Adrian was behind the project Chicago Crime Maps, and then moved on to become the, I believe his title, something like the editor of innovation at the Washington Post. So, he did a really amazing talk at, I believe it was at his alma mater, the University of Missouri at Columbia, to talking about the programmer as journalist, which is a lot of what, you know, you're talking about, taking and basically just saying there's a lot of data, a lot of information that comes into newspapers that then gets put in a flat file called a story.
Yeah, and you know, I really like that approach of saying, okay, what have we got, and how can we use this beyond simply just writing a story about it? You know, storytelling is really important, but at the same time, you know, you need to have a wider perspective sometimes on stuff. I mean, particularly things like crime, because it's very easy for certain sections of the media to get, you know, terribly sort of outraged and to take things out of context and blow things out of proportion. And I think, you know, when you are actually faced with the data, the raw data. It allows you to actually contextualize it yourself in a way that you journalists maybe can't do so well, because at the end of the day, you know, your context is your local area, and no journalist can write for you as an individual because they don't know what your local area is. They don't know, you know, what your concerns are. So I think, you know, giving people the raw data is a highly valuable thing to do.
Well, I think also the other thing is some of the projects that Adrian's doing, you can get buy-in from the journalists and the editors by showing how not just gathering this data, but having some structure to it actually makes journalists' jobs easier. So internally at the Washington Post, now they have this great resource that if they want to pull up information about U.S. soldiers who've been killed in Iraq, they have this huge, rich resource online, and there's probably a fair bit of... To do that online, they have to build a database inside. And now they have all of this information on soldiers who have been killed. So, I mean, that, I think, is a, you know, definitely an opportunity that a lot of news organizations are missing, that Adrian's pointed out, which is this is not just, you know, it's a win-win internally and externally. You're able to gather all this information, put it in some kind of meaningful format, and then present it in much more compelling ways to your audience. So it's useful for your journalists, it's useful for your audience.
And I think this actually reminds me of some of the presentations that Tom Coates has given. He talks about a web of data, and he talks about how the internet is data, not pages. And you have to think very hard about, you know, when you're creating a website, about what data is it that you're presenting and how. And I think, you know, this maps directly across. You know, journalism now is a web of news, and you have to think not just about the story that you're telling, but also how it fits in to the wider landscape of news, and actually taking an API view of news and figuring out, okay, you know, how do we gather this data together? How do we sort of like standardize the formats? I mean, this immediately makes me start thinking of micro formats, which is, you know, structured ways of representing data within a web page. And as soon as you start thinking about the way that you structure the data within your story, you immediately create an opportunity for aggregating that data, and with aggregation comes increased value. So you can actually do more with aggregate data than you can do with one particular bit of data on its own.
Well, you know, I remember a few years back at the BBC, we had an Al-Qaeda team that basically, it was led up by Frank Gardner, who's the BBC's, one of the BBC's security correspondents. And he had a team of two or three producers gathering all this information on Al-Qaeda. And the problem was, internally, they were having difficulty making sense of it. Not making sense of it, but keeping track of it. I mean, they had interviews with security services and intelligence agencies across Europe, the United States, across South Asia, across the Middle East. That's huge amounts of data that they were gathering. And they were literally keeping it in Word documents and then searching Word documents. It was, and the funny thing is, the lead producer on it had left journalism for a while and launched a database company during the dot-com boom, and she was crying out for database resources. Yeah. At the time I tried to sell it. Look, why don't we bring some database resources either from the website or some other place in the organization, set this up, and then we could not only, you know, help the team that was trying to do this research, but also I had this idea of presenting a timeline of Al-Qaeda. So you had a timeline down the bottom which you could track, and you could track the movements of major figures. You could tick boxes on either major figures, major terrorist incidents, money inflows, outflows, and do that and present this in a really incredible way. And it would start to knit together a lot of different threads. And, you know, you talked about storytelling. It's not storytelling in a traditional way. It's storytelling through, you know, a massively interactive graphic, but it starts to help people make sense of a lot of information quite easily.
Because it's all about context, and you know this is the problem I think with a lot of the world has gotten so complicated, and there's so much stuff we're supposed to keep track of that without context you end up just kind of like drowning in information. And I think the data provides context that's invaluable.